Welcome to Health Matters, the Mental Health Edition. I'm your host, Dr. Todd Lebrano, psychologist filling in for Dr. Mark Vegan. My co-host is Shelley Visconti, counselor and licensed marriage and family therapist. This evening, we're discussing post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. We invite our listeners to call in with comments and questions. Our number is 1-800-552-8502. This evening, we have as our guest, mental health professional and former Shreveport firefighter, first responder, Mr. Glenn Robinson. Say hello, Glenn.
Hello, hello. How are you?
All right. And we invited him to the show to give us a perspective of how this particular phenomenon, this disorder, affects our first responders, because we don't really think of that. We think of them as our treaters and people who help us when, you know, they're the first ones to the scene. But they tend to see a lot of stuff, right, Glenn?
Absolutely, on a day-to-day basis. And the way we process it in the past has not been good.
Right.
Because in the past we held it all in, and at some point it would erupt and wouldn't be a pretty picture. But there has been a number of things that we've done to alleviate the guy having that much pressure on him at one time. And PTSD is certainly something that's has become very common in the healthcare profession. And because of that commonality, I think it's very important that we acknowledge it and then process it so that the individual can be better and helped by it.
Well, sure. And I guess it would be helpful if I would define PTSD for our listeners so that everybody's kind of on the same page. PTSD is an anxiety disorder that's generally due to some type of witnessed or perceived terrible experience. Now, it doesn't have to just happen to you. You can be a bystander in a circumstance and experience something like this. There's also some research to show that exposure to multiple less severe traumas can lead to a condition of post-traumatic stress disorder. Things like combat, of course, that's pretty common. Everybody kind of realizes that soldiers in combat see some pretty terrible things and can result in a condition of post-traumatic stress disorder. Some things that some people may not think about are people being, you know, victims of violent crimes, if they're robbed at gunpoint, let's say, things like that, abuse in the home, domestic abuse, sexual assaults, being threatened with a weapon, natural disasters, like, in, you know, this is the 10-year anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. Car accidents, surviving car accidents, surviving plane wrecks, being kidnapped, being held at gunpoint, just many things like that. And often we have the, I guess, misunderstanding that because it's not traumatic to me, it shouldn't be traumatic to someone else.
Yeah, everybody's going to experience it differently, and the same event may traumatize one person to the point of them developing PTSD, while another person, it may be traumatic, but they may not develop PTSD.
Right, that's exactly right. Everybody's different. We have, you know, a psychological term. We call it individual differences, but you can boil that down to say everybody's different. Everybody has different thresholds. You know, if I say I'm feeling pain, what is that to mean to someone else? You know, their pain may not rise to the same level as my pain. So we all kind of perceive things differently. And that's kind of the point of this. So being more understanding, more empathetic of people who are going through these kind of things is very important.
Well, and I think it's important to also talk about the fact that just vicariously, just listening, you know, we now know that a lot of mental health professionals listening to victims of trauma, just listening to that day after day, vicariously kind of experiencing that, can also develop PTSD from hearing about these really difficult things that people are experiencing. I think, Glenn, you were saying something.
Yes, I think that's a good observation to say that about seeing it over and over again. Not that it actually, in many cases, not happening to you, but to actually visualize it and then having to process it once you get back to, you know, your various homes is definitely something that takes a toll on mental health professionals, healthcare workers, trauma, you know, people that work in the trauma hospitals. They see it over and over again, and we never think about them. We always think about those ones who are directly in the line of fire, so to speak.
Yeah,
but,
exactly.
Yeah, but those that see it on a regular basis, you know, whether depending on how they process it after it's over, will determine whether they, you know, end up having PTSD or you know, something else of that nature.
Yeah, it's not. Yeah. It's important not to lose sight that the people who actually help us during those traumatic incidences are also or can also be victimized by that sure. same experience. Sure. And they see this often, more often than we do.
Yes.
Or, you know, a layperson would. So, you know, if you are such an individual, a first responder, you know, a police officer, a mental health professional, it's important to understand your limits and when you should seek help as well.
Yes, yes. And that in itself, it's a great tool to have, especially when you have not necessarily understood your limits. And in some cases, people don't understand their limits, and they're trying to deal with it and not really dealing with it.
Yeah.
And so that is their limit. And at that point, they do need to seek professional help.
Right. So, now, I was going to say, I'd like, if listeners, you would like to join our conversation, please call in with your questions at 1-800-552-8502.
How common is PTSD? How often does PTSD occur?
Well, about 60% of men and 50% of women experience some sort of traumatic event. Of these people, about 8% of men and 20% of women actually develop a post-traumatic, a stress disorder, a PTSD. Now, the reason for this is, like I said before, everybody's different. Everybody copes with things differently. Now, you know, if you go through a car wreck, a car accident, or you have, you know, you see somebody get harmed, particularly, you know, and that's in a terrible way, it may disturb you. Naturally, it's going to disturb you, you know, for a little bit. Now, if you don't get over that in, let's say, you know, 6 months, and you still are struggling with that kind of experience, then I would say you probably need to go and find some help.
So what kind of symptoms, what kind of things should people be looking for to try to determine whether they have developed or are developing PTSD?
Well, symptoms like nightmares, recurrent dreams, that bring you back and make you feel the same way as when you first experienced that traumatic event. It could be maybe a smell somewhere brings you right back to that moment that it happened. Now, I said about 6 months. If you're really still struggling this, and, you know, after a 3 month period of time, you may want to talk to someone. So I stand corrected. But, you know, if these symptoms like the recurrent dreams, always looking over your shoulder, so we call that hypervigilance. It's, you know, it's really exhausting having to keep your eye on everything.
Yeah, and anticipating danger everywhere.
Right. Yeah. The common belief is in people who have experienced these traumatic events is that the world is no longer a safe place. It's dangerous. You know, before such events, people have a conception that, you know what, it's dangerous out here, but it's really not going to happen to me. So if I were to give a percentage of the probability that something's going to happen, I would say maybe 30%. Mm. And so I'm 70% safe. Now, after a trauma has occurred, it kind of flip-flops. Now it's 70 to 80 to 90% dangerous, and it's very It's very low that things are safe. So, you know, I may not ever leave my home.
Yeah, so it becomes difficult to determine whether a situation is truly dangerous or you're just perceiving it as dangerous when it's maybe not that terribly dangerous?
Oh, absolutely. Everything becomes inflated. Mm-hmm. Everything is dangerous. You're always looking over your shoulder. I always give an example when I have a client in the office talking about going into Walmart. People with post-traumatic stress disorder, you know, when I generally treat them, have problems going into places where there's large groups of people.
Yeah, usually Walmart is my, like, final homework assignment when I'm treating somebody with
typically,
PTSD.
Yeah.
If I can get them in Walmart and they can do all their grocery shopping, then we've done a pretty good job.
Right, right. Absolutely. I do the same thing.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, and they always seem to start nodding their head when I'm giving this example. It's hard to keep your eye on everybody.
Yeah.
Right.
And they're trying to.
Mm-hmm.
And it just wears them out. And in that same frame of mind, when you're worn out, you're tired, you're irritable. So your mood changes drastically.
Right.
And that's not to, you know, mean that depression's not a part of this too. But you get irritability, you get this hypervigilance, this always looking over your shoulder, always looking for danger. And, you know, and guess what happens when you're looking for something?
Find it.
You're going to find it.
Yeah.
And avoidance is kind of the big, you know, a big hallmark characteristic of this. You avoid any circumstance that will remind you of what happened, of the thing that you experienced. And that may, you know, be alcohol. That can also include, you know, drugs, substance abuse. Can also mean that you're never leaving your house because I don't feel safe anywhere else because this is the environment I can control. It may mean that I'm never going to go to I'm never going to go to the bank again because I was held up, or I'm never going to go to Walmart again because, you know, something bad happened to me in the parking lot. I don't know. There's lots of forms of avoidance out there, but that's, you know, that's pretty characteristic of PTSD. I think we talked about negative changes in mood. People with PTSD may seem less empathetic or sympathetic for other people. They don't, almost like what we were talking about before, they don't think that you should be hurting that badly if something happened. You shouldn't be that upset because it doesn't upset them very much.
Okay.
Kind of emotional numbing, mm-hmm. as it were. Of course, they lose interest in things that they used to do. They may become overly fixated on protection, buying firearms, just anything that they can do to kind of reinforce their sense of, I guess, protection, safety, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I've had clients who have started hoarding to actually create a barrier, you know, between them and doors and windows and things like that. So,
I have known of people who, if you don't call ahead and tell them you're coming, mm-hmm. you don't step into their yard because they will shoot at you.
Wow.
They don't feel safe, and they believe that everything is dangerous outside of their home, and they will do what they can to stop that. So it is largely based on perception, as you said before, mm-hmm. Shelley.
Mm-hmm. What about the guilt and shame? Glenn, do you find that within the fire department, within the police department, that when y'all do lose someone, which I'm sure is inevitable,
sure.
Guilt, shame, if someone does develop PTSD or if someone survives, that guilt and shame that goes along with the survival, can you speak any about that?
Yeah, the guilt and shame is definitely something that's prevalent in most of the law enforcement and firefighter type of positions or jobs. Is male dominated, and so the understanding is that men, particularly honorable men that hold those type of healthcare positions or public servant positions don't experience. You know, they don't feel, they're numb to it. And so when they do succumb to it or acknowledge it, then there is a little bit of shame, because in some realms it may quote unquote be a sign of what we would call weakness, and then at the same time really it's an acknowledgement that you've reached your limit.
Yeah, so you have to
be, so there is some shame in
you're just human. That's acknowledgement.
Yeah, you're just human. That's exactly right.
So you have to be rough and tough.
Well, I mean, you put on that facade to, you know, uphold the nobility of the service that you're doing, but then at the same time, when you do acknowledge that you are human, and you know, and in being human, you can say that I need some help. I think once it's just like a snowball effect. Once one person acknowledges that, then others have come after them saying, "Okay, yeah, I feel the same way," and so the shame comes with the first person initially, you know, because everybody's looking at him and saying, well, okay, man, how do you, and then once the processing of that individual starts, and then they say, well, okay, you know, I'm experiencing the same thing. So it's definitely prevalent in the fire department. Now it's gotten a whole lot better as it relates to us coming to the table and acknowledging that you know, that we do have forms of that, and it comes and goes. And you know, you process it differently from somebody else.
So you're talking about changing the whole culture of people, and I will say this in deference to you ladies, who are fire people and police officers, that, you know, which these professions have been largely male dominated in the past.
Sure.
And so you're supposed to be rough and tough. You get hurt, oh, just rub some dirt on it.
Right.
You know, get up and drive on. You know, that's the old military perspective.
Sure.
You know, get up and drive on. You're all right. So it's kind of the case of, let's take the John Wayne poster off the wall. You know, you don't have to be rough and tough and, in, you know, have the big S on your chest and all of that. You really need to show some vulnerability, and it's okay.
Right. And I think in a lot of cases we're our own worst enemy, because we do perform heroic jobs and situations. We are in them, you know, on a day to day basis. But then at the same time, for us to acknowledge that we're human, in spite of, first of all, you know, even though we're trained to do certain things, but we're still human, and to acknowledge that would actually make us stronger, as opposed to being the weaker.
We want to invite our listeners to join our conversation. Call with your question at 1-800-552-8502.
Well, I think a good question would be, does everyone who experiences a traumatic event develop PTSD?
Well, certainly not. Just like you said earlier, that people have different limits. People have different ways of processing things. And so everybody that, you know, either visualized or is part of a traumatic event, I think it can lead to PTSD, but not in every case.
Well, and aren't there some factors that increase the likelihood that someone might develop PTSD?
Well, there are, actually. There's some research that shows, actually, your level of education will inoculate you to some degree against suffering from a traumatic disorder. Also, in the military, does a pretty good job of this. It's called stress inoculation, mm-hmm. where you, in fire department, does this,
yes.
as well. Police,
yes.
department, I believe, they conduct this kind of training pretty routinely. You put your officers and members of the, you know, I guess civil service, so to speak,
right.
and military into stressful circumstances and kind of teach them how to operate in these circumstances. And, you know, and you give people skills to be able to cope with things like
this. So essentially familiarizing them with being in stressful situations and getting them used to being stressed out and.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
okay.
Actually.
Mm-hmm.
without, you know, I mean, and then we have all kind of exercises and drills and things to put an individual in that situation. It's controlled, but it does have some similar situations that will put them in that high stressful, you know, environment.
Well, sure. I mean, we do some work with law enforcement, and we've gone and done some of the training with them, and then also with the fire department. Yes. And it's whether it's real or not, it was certainly stressful for me.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, going into a burning building, even though it was a controlled burn, it was still pretty darn
still pretty stressful.
Yeah.
I think anything that presents a form of danger to you is going to be, you know, it's going to be stressful. However, like Todd said, with the educational component and the training that you receive, that because it's repetitious and because you see it over a period of time, it tends to not be as stressful after the first or second, you know, time that you're exposed to it. But it can be stressful. I remember a situation where we have EMT students that ride out with us when they're doing their practical. They mm-hmm. have to have so many hours of riding out on the fire truck and the medic unit with us. Well, I remember this one EMT student, we had a traumatic event on the interstate where this individual was changing the tire on the outside lane, which meant he was exposed to the traffic, and he got hit. And the splatter of everything that was in the truck was all over the place. Well, we couldn't find the individual. And so I told the lady that was there, I said, you may not want to see this, because I didn't know where he was, but I knew that he wasn't going to be in a compromise. He was going to be in a compromising position. And so I kept telling her, no, this is not anything you want to see. You hadn't, you know, this is not what you want to see. Well, it went on, and we found him up under the truck, and the truck had actually just kind of doubled him over, basically. And she saw it and had to go home after that. So that's what I say about, you know, once you're exposed to a traumatic event, you know, that you hadn't been trained to see or you hadn't seen over a period of time, it becomes something that, you know, when you see it, you're like, oh my goodness, this is real. Mm-hmm. And this is something we see, you know, all the time. So not that we become numb to it, but it's just, you know, after a while, you process it differently.
Right. I was just about to say that this, not to say that this just calluses you
sure.
to these kind of events, but you do have a certain level of desensitization. Mm-hmm. And it's almost a protective mechanism for mm-hmm. yourself.
Oh, yes, yes.
That you, because you are exposed to these things over and over, but that doesn't mean that they don't get to you, that they can't, you know, kind of chink through that armor you've built up.
Yeah, you have to learn to compartmentalize, but you also have to be careful not to compartmentalize so much that you completely remove yourself emotionally from family and friends and completely shut down, because that is one of the dangers with the kind of work that mental health or first responders or nurses or whatever, that you become so compartmentalized that you don't feel anything.
Right.
You know, you keep it turned off, even not just at work, but also at home. So,
I mean, kind of like yourself, Glenn, I have a little story, even, you know, personal, you know, and I've been treating this for a little while now. I viewed something particularly traumatic, and I remember going home and just trying to keep it in that compartment, keep it in that little box, as we're trained as mental health professionals, and it just not doing a very good job at it.
Mm-hmm.
And I came home, and my wife looked at me, and she said, just, I guess it was my face, and she said, just go do what you need to do to take care of this. But I just remember trying to hold that back, which is exactly the opposite of what I tell everybody else to do.
Yeah.
And I remember it's like the words were imprinted on the screen in my mind. Why am I doing something that I teach others not to do?
Right.
And I let it go. And it just kind of came out, and I was much better for it. You know, I mean, it was still pretty traumatic, and it had an effect on me, but I got over it. I got through it. And I think that, you know, sometimes this is a cause of PTSD, that we try to bottle this stuff up And it's difficult for anyone who has occupations where they see just terrible things, if not a day-to-day basis, but more often than most people do. It's, you know, we shouldn't learn to bottle this stuff up like that. And I'll be kind of stereotypical right now. Men are almost to a T trained to be like that mm-hmm. from birth.
Yes.
You know, don't cry.
Yes.
Don't
show emotion.
Don't show emotion. Yes. That didn't hurt. You need to dry it up mm-hmm. and move on, you know.
Sure.
In other words, keep all that inside. And so, you know, we're kind of taught to compartmentalize this. And, you know, I would say it's kind of the similar circumstance with our first responders, with our police officers. And I know with our military personnel, they've got other things to worry about than, you know, processing the emotions at the time that they see a friend die sure. or something has happened to them. Well, I need to stay alive myself. I need to keep my team members alive. I need to do this. I need to drive on. I got other things to focus on. So it's very easy to kind of get caught in this trap of burying these things, which opens us up for, you know, PTSD.
Listeners, we'd like for you to join our conversation. Call with your questions at 1-800-552-8502. And I think I cut you off, Glenn. Were you about to say something?
No, go ahead.
Okay. What about acute stress disorder? What is acute stress disorder?
Well, to be a little flip about it, it's kind of pre-PTSD.
Okay.
Mm. It is all the symptoms pretty much of PTSD except for a short period of time. It's from, you know, 0 days to 3 months, I believe, if I'm correct in the diagnostic criteria. Because PTSD, you have to have these symptoms for a little while before you can be diagnosed with PTSD.
Because, I mean, wouldn't many of these symptoms be normal? A normal reaction, it's persisting that's the problem, and that's what needs the treatment. It wouldn't necessarily be abnormal for you to experience some of these symptoms, but if it persists and it is interfering with your daily functioning, then that's when you need to intervene.
Yes, if it's, you know, if it's persistent and it causes problems in your job, your social life, your academic world, that's when it becomes an issue.
Yeah, because being upset by a traumatic event and being angry or irritable or depressed or anxious afterwards, I would think that would be very...
Well, that's natural.
Yeah.
That's natural. I mean, you should be... If you're not bothered, if you know, a loved one passed away, we've got some other issues going on there.
Right. That's another...
So it is natural. It's a natural occurrence to feel poorly when something bad happens to you, you know? So that's acute stress disorder. Now, how do they differ? It's really the time involved. If someone thinks they have PTSD, what should they do? What does the fire department do if, you know, you have, let's say, your EMTs respond to someone dies while they're treating? I mean, that's pretty traumatic. What do you guys do?
Well, in place we have what we call critical incident stress debriefing. And the debriefing has not only occurred after a major fire where it may have been a fatality, it's occurred after a medical call where multiple persons, especially children, have, you know, either been drowned or some other type of trauma has been inflicted on them and they end up dying. And so that has really helped us to process traumatic events to the point where we now have in place as well that some follow-up to say that this person was not doing a whole bunch of talking. That's not good. And so the critical incident stress debriefing is all of the companies that responded and the chief in most instances, or one that's highly trained in that particular critical incident stress, facilitates the meeting.
So you have a peer talking, another
yeah,
fireman.
We have another fireman that
doing
actually,
that.
Right.
Not a psychologist, not a pastor, not a counselor. Another,
in some cases, the pastor is there.
Well, and I understand that someone that may be good to have someone there, but another fireman leads this process.
That's the initial meeting. That's the initial meeting. If there's a need, or if they perceive that there's a need to have some following or subsequent meetings, then the professionals, the mental health professionals, mm-hmm. are brought in at that point. We have had some guys to it kind of linger much longer than maybe anticipated. And in the past, because we had little knowledge of it, he would be shamed. He would be talked about, unfortunately. But now that we have more education on it and more experience, you know, and then we see where other departments have been affected by it, then now we've taken a greater role, a greater concentration on making sure that we talk to him, he has a good support system, he or she has a good support system, and have follow-up meetings from that point on.
Well, good. Yes. I think we have a caller.
Yes, we do. We have Kay from Pineville. Kay, go right ahead with your question.
Well, I just wanted to ask, I was a trauma nurse for a lot of years, and many times when we would have something that was tremendously traumatic, decapitation, you know, something that was just gruesome, some of the EMTs, paramedics, even nurses, would almost be hysterically laughing. And like, is that a normal response to distress? I know that it upset other people that they were laughing instead of, you know, crying or vomiting or some of the other responses.
Sure.
Well,
I actually have a family member who, whenever they are upset, they laugh instead of cry. I mean, I think that sometimes people, when they have an extreme emotional reaction, they don't really know what to do. And so sometimes inappropriate emotions or inappropriate reactions may occur. Todd, Glenn, what do y'all have to say about that?
I think so as well. I know in those critical incident stress debriefing, there have been situations where the guys may not have been laughing, but may have not taken it the same way that one individual is taking it. So I don't think it's a matter of being insensitive to it. I think it's just a matter of them having their way of processing it, their way of dealing with it. And once it does sink in, then that may change. But if it continues, then I don't think there's anything wrong with it.
And my experience with this is that it's almost a protective mechanism for themselves, that you're trying to keep this terrible thing from, you know, hurting, you know, blame y'all for making me psychological, but damaging your ego, you know, your sense of self, that, you know, you experience this trauma, that it's, I've got to do something other than just feel this deep despair. So, you know, it's almost irony.
Yeah. Right. So the laughter creates a barrier.
Right.
Almost. Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we actually have another call. We have Lee from Leesville, actually.
All right.
Lee, go right ahead with your question.
Yes, ma'am. How do you know if you have this problem? This post-traumatic stress.
Okay, so Lee would like to know, how do you know if you have PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder?
Well, PTSD is you know, any psychological disorder. If it is impacting your ability to function on a daily basis in your job, if you go to school, in your social life, if it's affecting your relationship significantly enough that you're starting to do poorly, you know, you're getting bad job performance reviews, and you have the symptoms of PTSD, which, you know, the hypervigilance we discussed earlier,
the flashbacks, the nightmares,
you'll have some pretty wide mood swings as well, some irritability, and avoidance symptoms like drinking, not wanting to go places that remind you of what happened, not being able to enjoy the things that you used to do. Symptoms like this might be worth you having a conversation with a professional about, and really sitting down with them and determining whether or not you do match some of these symptoms enough to be diagnosed with this.
So if you suspect it, then talk to a mental health professional who's trained, because I know it's very important to try to get treatment pretty early, because the earlier we can catch it, usually the
less lengthy it'll be.
Yeah. Yeah, the less resistant to treatment.
And if you have, you know, if you're a veteran, a military veteran, you have resources that are available to you. You have the VA and you have veteran centers. Firemen, police officers generally have people inside their departments that can help them with this. Psychologists, mental health professionals associated with that. Yeah. And if you work in other facilities, you know, usually there's an employee assistance program. And just failing any of that, you can certainly look a psychologist or a counselor up in the phone book and have a conversation with them. And more times than not, they're going to be willing to help, or at least direct you to some place where you can find some assistance.
We thank you for our callers, and we have actually another one. We have Dan from Alexandria. Dan, go right ahead with your question.
Hello. So my question is, are there any other psychological problems that make people more disposed to coming down with the PTSD, or that will enhance it, you know, underlying problems that make them more predisposed to it?
So Dan's question is, what predisposes people to developing PTSD?
I don't know the research on people being predisposed to having or being more sensitive to PTSD. I would think that someone who has a problem with chronic depression, or possibly maybe some of the various personality disorders like dependent personality disorder or borderline personality disorder, things that generally people have when they have a low sense of self, a low self-esteem, so they're just vulnerable to begin with.
Yeah, and I know, like, early childhood trauma, even though the childhood trauma might not have created PTSD, it still kind of primes you for any traumatic event that might occur in adulthood to then to develop PTSD. And then also you know, a biological relative with depression or anxiety is going to predispose you to anxiety or depression.
So like a family history of mental health problems. Lacking good support systems can also predispose that. But I think that's about all that I'm aware of that may predispose someone for this, but this doesn't mean that, you know, this isn't a stamp of doom or anything on someone, that, you know, it's just an increased risk.
Yeah, just because someone has anxiety or depression or something, that they're going to necessarily develop PTSD if they have a traumatic event, just increases the likelihood.
Right.
Yeah. So how do we diagnose PTSD?
Well, I mean, this is done by a licensed professional, and I'm not sure, Shelly, you're a licensed professional counselor. Can a LPC diagnose PTSD?
We generally would refer that to a psychologist to do a diagnosis. We could definitely assist with diagnosis, or we could assist with treatment, but usually we want to have a psychologist or a psychiatrist on board to assist with the treatment. And then also, you know, if medication is needed, LPCs don't prescribe, so a medical psychologist or a psychiatrist would be able to prescribe medication if that was indicated.
Right. And I hate to put labels on people, that a counselor, you know, an LPC that can do a good job is still perfectly able to treat this disease.
Sure.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, it does take a psychologist and psychiatrist to diagnose this, but it does not take a psychologist or a psychiatrist to treat this. But we have a manual, the Diagnostic and Statistic Manual. We're now in the version 5 of that, that contains all the criteria and the ins and outs and symptoms that are necessary for a diagnosis of PTSD. The symptoms have to meet those guidelines. But that doesn't mean that you cannot be treated. I've treated plenty of people who may not reach the threshold of being diagnosed with PTSD, but man, they've got just enough symptoms.
Oh, sure.
That
yeah, they still require treatment.
The treatment for PTSD does them just as well as not.
Yeah, yeah, it could be a subclinical, as we would call it, that still would require the same type of treatment, and could still be, you know, just distressing, even though there might not be a formal diagnosis. Listeners, join our conversation. Call with your questions at 1-800-552-8502. So what about kids? Can kids be diagnosed with PTSD?
You know, in the past, that was a big argument in the field of psychology, that children, you know, could not be diagnosed with PTSD because they didn't feel like they had the ability to dissociate. However, there has been tremendous argument on both sides of that. And it has come, you know, in the DSM-5, they have now a diagnostic criteria to diagnose children with PTSD who are younger than 6 years old.
So you said disassociate. What is that? What is disassociation?
That is a hard phenomenon to describe, but I usually give an analogy of that. It's almost like watching yourself do something like it's on television, almost like you're playing a video game.
Yeah, usually I have patients describe it as watching a movie, or they are in the room and they know what's going on, but it's not actually happening to them. They're actually almost like watching it happening to somebody else.
Right. So if somebody has a flashback, so to speak, and you know, they're having a recurrent image of something happen, and they just kind of go into robot mode. And I've had people describe this to me like, man, I was just like watching a movie.
Right.
So the argument was that kids couldn't do that because they didn't have the ability to abstract, right? Algebra, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, kids 5 years old typically can't do algebra. They can't make symbols replace one with another. So because that, and that was an exclusionary criteria for them. But, you know, thankfully this has changed. I was one of the, you know, people who had a big argument that, sure, kids can be diagnosed with PTSD. You know, I treated a child early in my training who was afraid of water, was afraid to get in a bathtub because he was in New Orleans during Katrina.
Yeah.
Wow.
And that's a common, you know, common tale. And you couldn't tell me, you couldn't convince me that that child didn't have PTSD.
Yeah.
Because he's had just every one of the symptoms that an adult would have except for that disassociation.
Well, when you think about television and all the games that they're exposed to, and all of that, we can kind of reverse that fact that kids are exposed to traumatic events. Not only are they exposed to it, they see it on a regular basis. It's on all social media.
Sure.
You know, it's being replayed and over and over again. So that's definitely a criteria
but
for them.
But they are not little adults.
Right, right.
But I think we have a call.
Yes, we do. We actually have Penny from Shreveport. Penny, go right ahead with your call.
Thank you. My comment is about the statement that was made regarding the LTC's ability to diagnose PTSD. Actually, our state licensing laws, I'm an LTC and LMFT, and our state licensing laws do allow us to diagnose post-traumatic stress disorder. So I just wanted to make that comment and correction.
Sure. Oh, thank you for that clarification.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
So we were talking about kids with PTSD. Now the treatment is a little bit different for children with PTSD. You don't do the same types of things you do with adults. Of course, I mean, because they're not little adults.
Little adults, right.
You have to treat them a little differently.
Yeah, you have to.
Which kind of brings us into, what do you do about PTSD? I mean, there's a variety of things. I think Shelley brought up the fact that we often use medication. So that's a consideration. Oftentimes with PTSD, there are antidepressants prescribed. Many times they have problems with sleep. So there's some type of sleep aid prescribed. And that's just among other things. If there's, you know, different medications, maybe, you know, mood stabilizers are added at times. But predominantly the best form of treatment for PTSD is an exposure type of therapy, which falls in the class of cognitive behavioral therapies. Now, evidence-based therapies, of those cognitive behavior therapy, those exposure therapies, there are two that are probably more effective than any of the others. That's prolonged exposure therapy and cognitive processing therapy. Now, that's not to say that there are not other therapies that are effective in treating this. Those have the evidence and the of the outcome studies of being the most effective treatments for that. Now, those programs generally last between 12, can last from 12 weeks on up. Most people require more than one treatment. And I will say these treatments are manualized, so they require more than one exposure treatment course. That's the word I'm looking for, course of treatment. But there's also acceptance and commitment therapy, where there's being some research done on that and its effectiveness. Group support is almost always necessary, and it's very useful for that, because people will often believe that they're the only one suffering from this. And it's good, you know, kind of like in these critical stress debriefing programs, that you have the groups. You have the groups of other officers, other firemen that are there saying, no, you're not the only one here.
Right.
And that's an important thing for people to hear. And we have another caller.
Yes, we do. Great. We have another caller. We have Denise from Carthage. Denise, please go right ahead with your question.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. And it's not so much a question. Can you hear me okay?
We sure can.
Yes.
Yeah. Listening to everything, and I'm originally from New Orleans, and 10 years ago I ended up in the North Texas area by way of Katrina. Got a job, and I didn't know I had PTSD, and it was Hurricane Katrina related, for almost a year.
Wow.
You know, I would be emotional. I was homesick and all of that. And it was when my job became more demanding, that I like, my schedule changed, and it was more fixed, so I couldn't, like, take a break when I needed to. And I'd be sitting in my chair, and I'd just start crying. No reason. Couldn't stop until I did. And when the weather was bad, I would have a need to be away from people, because I didn't like being around people in storms. You know, like, I don't like being around people when they're afraid, because they do things that are unpredictable. So I realized if I didn't get some help, I was going to lose my job, because I couldn't control what was going on. So I was smart enough to go and get a good therapist and, you know, trust that process. And I guess sometimes you hear the PTSD, but you never think that that's what it is, and it's, okay, you're displaced. You're in a situation in a new world, because that's what Texas was for me. And everything going on, you know. But it took a year for me to see that something's wrong.
Well, thank you for sharing that with us, Denise. I think that that's good for people to hear, and to be reminded that it's not just situations like abuse, or that you know, natural disasters are just as traumatic, and especially Katrina, because there were so many catastrophes and traumas and tragedies that occurred to people just one after the other. And I think that that's good that you realized it and you were able to receive some treatment. But oftentimes people don't realize that they have PTSD until there's some kind of stressful event, some kind of stress in their life that brings it to the surface, like you experience. Thank you so much for sharing that with us, Denise.
And oftentimes it's another coworker, it's a boss, it's a friend that says, hey, you know, something's wrong. We need to, why don't you come with me, if you have a friend or a coworker or someone like that, and let's go find you someone. Or it's a coworker that says, look, you need to go do something about this. or it's a boss, unfortunately, if it gets to this point, you need to go do something like this before you come
before
back to
you
work.
Lose your job.
You know, if you have the occupation that will allow you the time to go take care of problems like this, as oftentimes military does, law enforcement and fire department does, they allow their officers the time to go and do this. I think it's just, it's again, we're in the culture, the tough man, the tough person culture that, well, that can't be me.
Right.
That's not me. So I don't need that. You know, so we get kind of caught in that, and we need to understand. And if you have a coworker or a friend or a relative that's fallen into this, it may be upon your shoulders that you need to go and say, hey, look, let's go have a talk. I'll walk that path with you. We'll go there and do this together. You know, they need support too. And I think we have another call.
Actually, we have someone that called in a question. They would like to know if EMDR or eye movement, rapid eye movement desensitization, if that works for PTSD.
There is some research that shows that it is, if I can stop being tongue-tied, it is an effective treatment for PTSD, although we are not really sure why or what about that particular treatment makes it more effective. I think the leading opinion or hypothesis is that it is a type of exposure therapy, and it is the exposure that does the most therapeutic work.
Yeah. Yeah, I actually have some training in this and did some research because there is differing opinions about whether it's effective or not. And there are brain imaging studies that do show that the brain does change in positive ways with this, but it appears that it is the processing, the talking about it, the working through it portion of the EMDR that seems to be effective. EMDR essentially is where you are watching a light or some other kind of object move from left to right while you are processing their traumatic event. And so we think that probably the most effective part of it is the processing of the event, the verbal processing of the event.
You know, and talking about treatments, there was a new treatment now available at Overton Brooks, the VA Medical Center. It's called virtual reality. They have a program called Virtual Iraq where they create I'll use some technical terms, an immersive environment to almost duplicate.
Yeah, we saw a presentation on it. It was really cool. The movements, the smells, the sights, the sounds, everything. Yeah.
And so they immerse you back into that environment that caused, you know, that's similar to the trauma, to expose you to that and desensitize you to that trauma. And the term is habituate you to that. So that, and as I explain it to my clients often, you hear it so often, you see it so often that you just get sick of hearing it and talking about it and seeing it. And then you say, oh, hey, well, it's not that big of a deal anymore.
Is that just for veterans?
Unfortunately, yes, yes, that is only for veterans. The most of the current and most recent research for PTSD comes out of the Veterans Administration. Mm-hmm. I guess that's because it's the most visible victims of PTSD. So a lot of that research comes out of that. Now, cognitive processing therapy was originally created to treat women who were victim of sexual traumas, and then they later adapted that for military uses. Prolonged exposure was originally designed to treat PTSD in soldiers, and it has since been adapted to treat other forms of PTSD. But the virtual reality is very interesting, very exciting, because it takes advantage of our technology.
Yes.
As it has come along, and they actually use those virtual programs to treat phobias like being on airplanes, fear of heights, things like that. Wow. So it's pretty neat.
So, Glenn, what can people do if someone has PTSD, what can they do to lessen their symptoms? What would be some recommendations you would give to them?
One very important thing, and it's almost kind of sensible, something you don't think about, is take care of yourself. Self-care. A good healthy diet, along with exercise, relaxation. That goes a long way. Certainly avoid caffeine and nicotine. And you want a support group. You want to be able to talk to someone, because a lot of people think that they're the only one going through this. And once you start talking to individuals, maybe it's certainly others that are going through it, just hadn't expressed it openly. And stay connected. Stay connected. Don't isolate yourself to the point where you know you might have a phobia of going outside, but at least talk to someone, have some relationship on. You may even talk to them, you know, over your cell phone, any kind of contact or communication with the outside world without isolating yourself is definitely going to help you or lessen the symptoms.
So what about someone else who knows someone who is may have some of these symptoms?
Like a family member or a friend?
Well, I think certainly you want to encourage them to seek help, and you want to recognize that they actually have it, and be willing to listen. You want to have somebody to listen to them, and then in turn give them some help, and even to the point where you may want to take them where they need to be as relates to their
so maybe even go to an symptoms. Appointment with them.
Absolutely, or, yeah. Yeah. But I think the support can be in various ways, not only just being there physically, but it can be a checkup, you know, checking on them every week and making sure they're making their appointments and you know, doing some follow-up with them and things of that matter. And then you know, at the same time, you want to familiarize yourself with it so that it doesn't happen to you in the event that you're helping them, you know, mm-hmm. deal with their problem.
Well, sure, and the family member understanding that if the person is irritable or angry or depressed sure. or anxious, that's a normal reaction, you know, when you have PTSD, and maybe not to take it personally.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. That goes a long way with them being able to get better by the treatment and all that.
Yeah. So having that family support, having that friend there is very, very important.
Very
can be very
important.
Helpful to people. I think we just have a few more minutes left. Todd, any closing remarks or statements that you'd like to make?
Well, I would just like to remind our listeners that be aware if you see someone or you know someone that may be, you know, suffering from something like this, that support is a very important thing. You can be there for them and help them along this path. And it's not just firemen, it's not just the police officers, it's not just our military personnel, it's our trauma nurses, as you know, we've had one of our callers. It's anybody, you know, anybody can suffer from this if you have experienced some type of traumatic event. And I'd like to thank our callers that came, you know, that called in today, Kay, Lee, Dan, Penny, and Denise. We appreciate your comments and your questions.
And also, thanks to you, Glenn Robinson,
thank you.
For being here with us. We appreciate you being here.
Thank you so much.
Mental Health Matters is a program for informational purposes only. Consult a mental health professional or physician for all mental health concerns. Mental Health Matters is part of Red River Radio's Community Connection series of outreach programs. Guests on Mental Health Matters are not compensated and are selected by relevance to the topic. No fees are charged for participation in Mental Health Matters. This show is available for download from redriverradio.org. Mental Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran, with production assistance from Wally Derleth, Henry Edwards, Tim, and Tim Snell. Production of Mental Health Matters is made possible in part by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana, and also by the Gables at Spring Lake Gamble Guest Care's assisted living community, located behind Spring Lake Guest Care Center on Line Avenue in Shreveport. Learn more at gambleguestcare.com. Please join us next Thursday for Health Matters. The topic will be pediatric orthopedic disorders. I'm Shelley Visconti, along with Dr. Todd Lebrano. Thank you for joining us this evening.